Steve Baltin, and welcome to the First People Have the Power of 2021. I hope this is going to be a way better year for everyone. We're certainly starting the podcast off right with longtime friend, Bush frontman Gavin Rossdale. Really interesting conversation about the band's 2020 album, The Kingdom, having your songs misinterpreted, some of his favorite literature, and great protest songs from the likes of Patti Smith, The Sex Pistols, and one other really surprising choice that you're just going to have to tune in to hear.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, that's one of the things that's existed during this time. I mean, is, you know, it's been so fascinating to watch how everyone... Sorry, I just finished something. So now you have my undivided attention. But, you know, I got an email saying that I had to donate to starving puppies, and I can't fucking say no to that. So there you go.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know... Well, yeah, I know you're a big dog person too. And it's funny, I was just telling Amanda, my rescue dog is very upset because this is normally his walk time. So, you know, he now has to wait longer. But going back to what I said, it's very fascinating to, you know, watch how people have responded to this time. And it's been fascinating to see. And for me, it's been really interesting to talk to so many artists and see how everybody approaches it in such a different way. And, you know, it took some people a while to figure out. It's funny, like Travis Barker's a friend and we were talking about it. And it's like, he's like, I love this. He's like, I don't want to sound insensitive, but he's like, because I get to just work with all my friends and produce music and write. He's like, if I didn't have to tour again, honestly, I'd be happy with it. You know? Mm-hmm. So it's really different how each person responds to it. And it's like, you know, then you have like G-Eazy, for example, who's putting out these different covers, and you have Youngblood who did the different shows. And it's like, you're doing the stuff. And it's like, and then you have artists who are just like, fuck, I'm hanging with my family and I don't want to do anything.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing because also we have a record coming out. So that's pretty unusual because you want to keep the fires burning and keep talking about the band because it's a big cycle, beginning of the cycle. It's a weird cycle, an elongated like cycle with 16 wheels, I think, and how to keep the record alive until we tour again. This is challenging. But, you know, having said that, it's weird because when you bring out a record, you can only be in one place at a time. So, I mean, I know you do tour for months and months and months. It's weird, you know, like I've never considered the release of a record with the availability of going to see them touring. I mean, it's never been a combination that I've thought about. Never, you know. I mean, I get a record or a band I love and then a new song record comes out. And then if and when they come around, then I'm excited about seeing them. But I don't put the two... I know that's not the common wisdom of people like, oh my God, it's a marketing nightmare. How can you put a record out? You're not touring. It's like, fine, watch, you know. Yeah, it's all right.
It's kind of fascinating in that respect. I never thought about it, but you're right. In a way, you know, like you say, you can't play everywhere. So these opportunities where now you can, on release day, you can do a show that's streamed to the whole world and it's expected... Mm-hmm. And what you would do, it's kind of a different, you know, in a way, it's almost more beneficial because you can be everywhere at once versus playing, you know, the Forum or the Greek Theater in LA.
Funny you say that. Last week or a couple of weeks ago, whenever it was, I performed, I sent out various videos of stuff I've recorded, live recordings. And I don't have the benefit of studio, so my live is really live. I don't have the benefit of like, you know, it's live really, but I'm just going to like figure it in the, you know, going to tune it quickly and replay that guitar. No, mine's really live. And I was in Milan for the Tidal event for, I don't know, World Peace, you know, at the stadium. They played all these videos. I was performing somewhere in Northern California at an event, and there was something being played at a seminar in New York. So I was in three places. I felt like the Blue Man Group. I was like, there's a future in this. I like it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that's been one of the fascinating things to see how people are going to, you know, take this moving forward. And it's really, it's been interesting to see because I do think that, you know, there are elements of this, like John Sykes over at iHeart is a good friend, right? And we were doing an interview and we were talking about the fact that, you know, all the benefits they've put on, all the big events they put on, like the Robin Hood show and all this, were all done remotely. They have a few people there, sort of, you know, a few key production people, but all of the heads of the company are set up in different places. And it's like, now that people realize how easy it is to do things remotely, I don't know that you're going to see companies go back to a normal you know, okay, we've got to sit in 6-8 hour meetings. And it's funny for me, I live in Long Beach, right? Mm-hmm. I'm doing all my interviews now via Zoom versus driving to LA every day. I love it. It makes my life so much easier because I have so much more free time to do the interview, work, and then still have time to work out in the morning, cook dinner at night, things that, you know, when you spend 4 hours in the car, you have no time to do. So I think, you know, for some people, it creates like, it gives you opportunity to really get a different perspective and see things.
You do when you drive around. Go out and taking my kid to a play date yesterday and drive down Hollywood and you do see the desecration of, because what you just see is just businesses that are shut, restaurants. I saw Le Pain Quotidien next to, on the way from the doctor getting my son's cast off of his arm yesterday morning. That's restaurant leases for sale. So it's just like, that's a big chain. Now, I'm not a defender of everyday bread, Pain Quotidien, but you kind of get the sense, wow, just everybody is hurting. Everybody. There's no one that isn't, you know. I mean, you're quite fortunate in your job because you do two interviews at once now.
Nope, I shut it off. It's a landline I use only for interviews. And so I just quickly shut it off because it's annoying. And it's only, you know, telemarketers. But as you were, no, it's bad. I mean, and it's, you're right. And Travis and I were talking about that. You don't want to come off as insensitive because it's like for a lot of people, you know, obviously, and like Adam, the producer engineer, we were just talking about this before. I mean, you know, it's crazy because cases in California are skyrocketing. And, you know, Newsom was just talking about shutting down this, you know, I mean, there's so many people who are suffering. And you're right. I'm very lucky that I get to do my job remotely. And, you know, likewise, you get to make music, put it out, and, you know, still you get to share music with people, even if it's now in a different capacity.
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, for the most part, nowadays, of course, not. But back in the day when we actually sold records, if you can sell 5 million albums on a, you know, you can't possibly be playing to each of those 5 million people. It's all part of the zeitgeist and everybody's picking up on it and buying the records. So my goal and my dream is to, it's been quite bizarre. The, you know, with Golden State, with the Twin Towers being, you know, the Bin Laden attacks, the terrorist attacks, that destroyed that record. Remember, there was a cover of The Plane, there was Speed Kills was the song. We were chasing our tails, try to change things around. We had to change one thing in this record to do with this times, but generally this record's been incredible because if you look even back to the end of the last record, This Is War, which was written about Charlottesville, nobody picked up on that. And this is War, and I said, this is the strange fruit. And I thought somebody might be like, hey, that's Nina Simone's line. It's like, that was intentional. And it was really written in response to that. And then began with Bullet Holes on this record, and that had the Race Wars, Mind Wars, Planet Wars, Star War, whatever, Mind Wars, whatever it is. Race Wars, Planet Wars, Mind Wars, Star Wars. And then you had the beginning of COVID was Flowers on a Grave, which was this whole thing about isolation and loneliness. I don't know, have you heard any more songs?
Yeah, I've heard the whole record.
Oh, wow. Oh, goodness. I want to hear what you think. And then you got The Kingdom, which is, you know, the sort of, that could be any soundtrack to a peaceful march, you know, a sort of a constructive gathering of people to change the culture, change the ways, you know. It's a very fitting record. I don't want to say too much now, but I'm intrigued what you think. But you know what I mean? It's bizarre that this record feels as vital as the times.
Well, you know what's so fascinating about that is it's interesting because what I find more and more from talking with artists, right? Artists, I think Nick Cave put it so well when I was talking with him years ago. I only got to interview him once, but he said something that really resonated. He said a lot that resonated with me. But he talked about writing what it is you're longing for. What it is that, so if he's happy, he writes really sad songs. And if he's in a sad place, then he writes, like, for example, he told me honestly that he wrote Into My Arms while strung out on heroin, you know, in a church, because that's what he was longing for. And why I bring that up is Norah Jones and I were just talking about this. And it's like, I think artists become sort of prophetic without even intentionally really, because you're seeing things. And like she and I talked about her new record as well. It fits into these times in a way that when she started making it a year ago, you couldn't have anticipated. But it's interesting looking at it.
Well,
and
it's in the culture. It's in the air. It's in the air. It's in the air. And there is a sense of prophecy, which I think I've always felt. And often I've been sort of, more so the beginning, when it was more, my lyrics were more disconnected, more disjointed, because I was more disjointed and I was more fragmented. And so there's always is an interesting thing. Anyhow, so I think the record really fits, which certainly beats. It's way better than if I decided to like make my nature record. And this was like, dedicated to Darwin and the Sequoia Forest, because I really felt nature. This is the real me. Thank God for that. Thank God at least it's like, it's street level emotions,
Well, what's funny about that, though, is you say that, also I would imagine as well, and you and I have talked about this over the years, look, as an artist, you get more comfortable expressing yourself, you get more comfortable expressing your opinions. Also, you're a dad, things resonate with you much deeper than they did, I imagine, at the beginning of your career. So these things, these social issues you're writing about, you probably just feel them in a very different way than you would have thought. And also, you feel more comfortable, you feel more confident in your opinion, because you have 20 years of making music now. So yeah. You have that confidence to be able to say, okay, this is what I want to, because let's face it, a lot of people, when you're first coming up, you worry about, saying the wrong thing, alienating people, whatever, or you don't feel comfortable in your political opinion. But I think by nature, as you get older, and you have more experience, there is a confidence and an ability to say, okay, you know what, this is how I feel about this. And I'm going to feel, comfortable expressing it.
Yeah. I will remind you of like on our first record, things that never get picked up on as well when you begin, like songs like Bomb. Bomb was written about, growing up in Kilburn, with the Northern Irish English trouble. I grew up in a terrorist time where people would get bombed and, Mountbatten was killed and bombs went off in tube trains and on buses. And so I wrote that song Bomb, but it was written from a perspective of someone who goes out shopping and never comes back. So I've always tried to do stuff. It's funny also what people pick up on. At that point, my record was like skyrocketing and everything was like out of control and people couldn't work out if they loved me or hated me. So no one was actually looking into it going, wow, here's a personal take on the Irish struggles.
Yeah. Like you say, it's interesting too, because when you look at, other things off that record became successful. So it's funny how you get into, and this ties in with the podcast portion as well, which is, the People Have the Power, where people pick their favorite protest songs. But it's a really fascinating thing to see how you start off with like a hit like Everything Zen, right? Mm-hmm. And you become known as an artist, or like, Glycerine, and you become known as for these hit songs. But then you look at a band like U2, who I love, and they have a song like Sunday Bloody Sunday early on. And so they become known as this band of protest songs.
Right, but then there's
plenty of other stuff that is, has nothing to do with politics. Even if you look at early songs like I Will Follow, and October actually was more socially conscious, but, or Party Girl, for example. So it is a funny thing how people sort of get, it's like when I was an English major in school, and it was a really fascinating thing, right? I realized for every class, your teacher only grades the first piece. That's it. They decide on your first piece if you can write or not. After that, you don't have to try. once they've made up your mind, like, oh, you're a writer or not, they're like, okay, cool, you're good. And you can write gibberish. And I think it's very interesting to see how people pigeonhole, stuff and how you're able to get out of that over time. But it's interesting. Do you feel like people now pick up on stuff a little better?
I was just saying, for instance, like This Is War, I thought that was an amazing lack of, people enjoyed the song and it did pretty good at the radio. It was another hit. I don't know if we got into the top 20, but it was a really super socially conscious song. And there was a big fight at the beginning between the band and the management and the press, because when I went into the studio to record that vocal, just to get a sense of it, I wanted one song to write, and I wanted to do something a bit more, a bit heavier, and in a way precursing, this record now. The whole Charlottesville thing had happened, and I couldn't believe this far right, and the president. I turned on CNN when I was in the vocal booth. And literally by chance, they're on a hit record, and I had this speech where he says, what about the, you got to talk about the alt-right, what about the alt-left? there were terrific people on both sides there. Remember that speech he gave?
Yeah, of course.
And they recorded it. It's like, and then the track began, and everyone was like, my PR at the time, and actually the rest of the band, were terrified of alienating people. You know, they figured we have a lot of Trump supporters, don't do that. And that was when it was not, people weren't bashing him as much. But he hadn't made the kind of, I don't know, he got a lot of hall passes. He had a lot of hall passes, and he was in the middle of his hall passes, so somebody got through it. But so that's interesting to me. I suppose, like you say, you get pigeonholed in something like, you know, has a decent body, cannot have a good opinion about something. I don't know.
Well, you know, but I mean, it's so funny because this has come up in the news so much lately as we're getting into an election. And look, and I want to get to your protest songs in a minute because I imagine they tie in directly with the record, but it's fascinating. If you've been following, like, you know, the whole thing that just came up recently with Tom Morello trending on Twitter for trolling his fans, who, like, one person was like, Tom, stay out of politics. And, yeah. And Tom wrote him back, like, which music of mine doesn't have political ideology? Let me know so I can take it out of the catalog. And it's like, it's amazing. Like, Springsteen is my number one artist of all time, right? 2004, he did the Vote for Change tour, where he went out and toured and encouraged people to vote for John Kerry. And the number of people who were like, dude, I was a fan before, but, you know, your politics, fuck you. Like, I'm never going to listen to your music again. It's really? Like, the dude's made this music for 30-something years. So don't feel bad. You're in very good company of people not listening. If you write a good beat or a good hook, and I'm sure you know Aaron Bruno from AWOL Nation, right? I'm sure you know Aaron.
Right. I know the band, yeah.
Yes, it's funny. He and I were talking about, we're opening for Prophets of Rage on their tour, right? And we were talking about watching all the people in the mosh pit and how 50% of the people were not listening to any of the words and were just excited to be down on the floor, jumping up, and we're not paying attention to any of the message at all. And in anything, honestly, it's probably a testament. I never thought of this before, but, you know, it's probably a testament to the hooks you write that people just enjoy them and don't pay attention to the music, because it's not like a Joan Baez or Bob Dylan where the lyrics are so pronounced that, you know, you have to hear the message. But if you look at the number of people who misinterpret Springsteen or Morello or any of that, you're in very good company. Because
I mean, the thing is that, you know, people do with a large audience, you know, and whether or not I obviously can't compete with Bruce, but I can, you know, I'm not a million miles from Tom in terms of reach. And I get the lost poets, they feel me. They get a sense of me. In terms of the politics, it's been a sort of not a blind spot, but just something that I don't like force feeding people stuff. And what I've always been really careful of is doing that thing where you you know, you move into a didactic thing where you have a solution. I think it's the job of an artist to sort of elevate or illuminate things. But I mean, nobody's looking for Tom Morello to exactly work out how to make Medicare work. You know, no one's really asking him to go to Capitol Hill and to talk to lobbyists. It's not happening. But, you know, he's had a career I thought was hilarious. I only saw it in passing. Again, I didn't read the lyrics about this instance, but I just thought it was hilarious that someone was pulling him up on being political, because I was like, well, if he can't be political, what, you know, because it's a bit, you know, I thought it was pretty outrageous when that woman on Fox told LeBron to shut up and dribble.
Yeah.
Like, that was just like, I was like, I just could not believe that you have that arrogance to say that to someone, because everybody has an opinion, say what they want. And like, it's Laura Ingraham, right? And whatever her position is, you know, you've got to be very careful commenting on someone from this specific, like the African-American community, talking about racial injustice, which is completely justified. How can you sit there and tell him he shouldn't say anything, shut up and dribble? It's just, I mean, how she keeps her job? She keeps her job because everyone at Fox thinks that like that. So she's probably got a raise.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what they've been trying to do. It's really interesting, man, too, because as we're looking at this and we're having this conversation, and we'll come on to your protest songs to say, but it's funny because even when you look at songs like, you know, on the new album, like Our Time Will Come, Send in the Clowns, it's funny what you were saying about the lost poets, because I think it is like a, you know, I can understand that sort of like, what's the term I'm looking for? Like people who feel disenfranchised. you know, maybe right. feel like yeah. sort of isolated, you know, like
that's what I've always, you know, that's what I've often, you know, thought, but yeah.
Well, it's interesting for you that before we come out of your, I'm curious, when you think of being a kid, is there one artist who really jumped out at you who sort of spoke to that same sort of feeling of, you know, making you fit in? Because I think that's one of such the important things of music is, and I think that's why, again, it attests to the fact that you've been able to make music now for 30-something years is because, look, because when people feel that you understand them and can identify with them, that's such an amazing feeling of people feeling like, okay, I get you. You get me. That feeling of like what makes a great song. What I'm trying to say is, it's still early in the morning, obviously.
People identify with us. That's when people identify, and that's why I don't like to push things. I mean, for instance, yesterday I got asked one of the suggestions was doing a track by track commentary for the record and a lyrical breakdown. And I just don't want to do that. I just think the idea of force feeding like a gavage with a foie gras duck, you know, force feeding people an idea. My words, they start from my perspective, but that's where they start, and then you let them go and you can't hold on to them and say what they're about, you know. Whether I wrote This Is War about Charlottesville, it began as that, but it's about general oppression, you know. It's just about the oppression of people. And I can't stand it when people like go through each line where each line meant, because sometimes I think it's important as an artist to write songs or write lines that don't necessarily make sense to you at the time, because there's got to be some mystery even for the writer. There has to be some, you know, it's poetry. It's not a novel. So I find it strange, and I don't like to pinpoint that stuff. And I think that words are so personal, and that's why they affect people for so long. And that's how I can still sing those songs. I didn't sing Come Down about what I sang it about, but it's really easy to sing I Don't Want to Come Back from Down from This Cloud. You talk about Nick Cave. I can take in anything that I'm thinking of the day, and that's what I'm singing about. I can't possibly like retrace my steps.
Well, and it's funny because, I mean, songs do change and evolve over time, and it's an interesting thing too. I also, it's funny, if, you know, in all the interviews we've done, if you notice, I never ask anybody about specific lyrics, because I think that, you know, that's one of the things is that, you know, what makes it, I always look at, I use John Lennon's Mother as a perfect example, right? One of my favorite songs, that whole album is a perfect album to me. I didn't lose my mother till I was much later in life, but mm-hmm. you could still relate to the desperation and the pain in his voice. And that's what I was trying to get. What makes a great song is the universality, but it's also that feeling when you hear a song. And that first time you hear a song and you're like, how did that song get in my head? Like, how did that person know what I was thinking and what mm-hmm. I was feeling? And if you go through and say, okay, this song is about this, it was written by this, it takes that away. It takes away people's interpretation.
You know, it's like walking around the supermarket once someone's left you and you hear someone singing, if you take away the biggest part of me, you go walking around here, schmaltz, and you're like dying on the bread aisle. You know,
I love that. You know, I love that example because I love Ambrosia and all that 70s music.
It's beautiful.
Now, all right, cool. Let's come out to a couple of your protest songs and talk about how those. Because one of the things that with this show is that I like the idea of talking about how these songs both influence your writing and your ideals. And especially since we're talking about the fact so much that, you know, like a song like This Is War and how it goes about Charlottesville and how, you know, the kingdom and these songs that, you know, talk and bullet holes and how they talk about specific things happening now, mm-hmm. you know, are there songs that you've looked at and you admire for song? Because again, one of the things that's been really fascinating in doing these interviews and, you know, when you talk about a great protest song, it's a song that lasts for hundreds of years. I mean, it's funny because you talked about on the first record, The Bomb, writing about, you know, Ireland, and Sunday Bloody Sunday was written in 83 and that song still has pertinence today.
Yeah.
So what's one that comes to mind for you? And did you, it's funny because I mean, you know, you and I always riff and do stuff. So I don't know if you pre-prepared songs or not because everybody handles it differently.
I had a think about it yesterday. And when I read it, it's funny. The first thing straight away is Patti Smith with People Have the Power, because that to me is, you know, it was a great return to form. Remember, she'd been away for so long that she came back with that song, and she's such an enigmatic, beautiful writer, and the novels are incredible. And, you know, Babel was an incredible book of poetry. I mean, I just lived off of that. That was like my diet for my adolescence. And, but yeah, sometimes the you know, music hasn't always been as great as her words for her, you know, and People Have the Power. So that was a, you know, just a wonderful, simple, elegant message from a beautiful woman. You know, love.
Yeah, it's one of those songs too. It's funny, obviously. I mean, obviously I picked it for the name of the show, but it's one of those songs. Too. Yeah, I think it's one of the songs that, what I love about that song so much is when you hear it, it makes you feel like you can change the world.
Right.
You know, and it's funny because I've talked about this with other people on the show, and there's kind of a difference between songs that get you fired up and songs that are sort of songs appealing. And People Have the Power is the song that I think makes you feel like you can, you know, after you hear it, you come out of there, you know, especially when you see her live, you come out and you feel like you can change the world. And it's funny too, because, you know, you talk about her words, man. Just Kids is one of the best books I've ever read of any kind, mm-hmm. fiction, nonfiction, anything. I mean,
yeah.
Such an incredible writer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, so it's interesting when you hear a song like that, talk about, and it's funny because like you said, words are poetry. Songs in particular, they take on lives of their own. They emerge. Yeah. They teach you things themselves. So when you go back and look at some of your writing, do you hear her influence in there in a way that you hadn't thought of or that you hadn't noticed before? Because again, you know, songs tell you what good writing sort of shapes itself, and then it tells you what it's about.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I mean, as in like, looking back retrospectively, do things kind of, you know, illuminate themselves to me? Looking back, is that the question?
Yeah. And so specifically, do you hear her influence in stuff that you've done? And maybe it's not just People Have the Power, but like you said, Babel was such an influential...
Yeah, because I, you know, yeah, because there's a sort of... and it's interesting, it's a bit how she, you know, she writes in a fragmented way. You know, her novels are fragmented. That Babel was so erotic. When she talks about Edie Sedgwick, and it's just, for me as a young kid, just the eroticism of a beautiful woman singing about another beautiful woman, but in a tragic way. So that tragedy and that sexuality has informed most of stuff I've written. I like that. I like tragedy, sexuality, challenges, mistakes, redemption. And those are things that I recognize from her. You know, I pored over Bob Dylan's lyrics, but I never, and he's incredible, and the new record is, I'm really enjoying that. They're different stories. Like, I never could do that. I tried it for a minute. I once wrote a song called Johnny and Mary. It was like a fucking band that went nowhere. But I couldn't do the story stuff. And the way that Springsteen does that, I just can't do that. It sounds so disingenuous when I start singing about that. And I once met Tom Waits and I was talking to him because he does this sort of journeyman stuff, you know, driving in his Buick and all his stuff. So we got Tom Waits and Dylan, who are they're the most incredible lyricists ever. And obviously Kathleen Brennan, his wife, writes with him.
Yeah.
But they're just descriptive and they just blow me away because I just quizzed him for so long. And I was like, so do you just like writing all the time? You're so annoying because it's like, I write lyrics, but I can't, you know, do you just write the whole time? You know, he's like a sponge for everything he sees as he drives. It's almost like he's like a mosquito net driving through the countryside. And when he gets in, he just unpicks all the mosquitoes, bits of information. Every mosquito is a different line for him. Every mosquito is a different character, a different word, you know? And so I was inspired by them, but I never could enter into their world. I just tried to make my lyrics as bright and effervescent as theirs are. But with Patti Smith, there's an underlying sexual tension that I really like. And I hope permeates everything I do because that's a beautiful place to write from.
Interesting. So what's the next protest song?
God Save the Queen. Sex Pistols changed my life. Changed everyone's life in England. Changed the world. That was the beginning of punk music. Sorry, New York. just for me. Just yeah, it was a revolution. Never known anything like it. And I saw them as a kid when I was, I didn't see them on play. I mean, they were on TV when I was 11, 12 years old, swearing at Bill Grundy on the TV, you dirty old fucker. And they were like, they were losing their minds. And there was a revolution going on. And I'd never heard anyone be disrespectful to the Queen. And I remember going to this record store up the road from where I grew up, like the next up the street, like 5 minutes walk, right up the top of my hill. When I went in there, and I'd read about this band, and they were, and I remember going back, and I remember standing in my, you know, in my dad's like living room, playing this song, and it was really abrasive to me because I'd never really heard anything like it. But I was like, "You've got to like this. This is the future. This is the future." I was like, "Cool. It's not exactly Bohemian Rhapsody, is it? It's really abrasive." But I just fell in love with them, and you know, and so "God Save the Queen" was just this uprising against the monarchy, which may not have prevailed, but now it's, the monarchy has become more and more, or less and less. So it's sort of like a tourist attraction. And for most English people, they're sort of, you know, I'm not a royalist. I'm not bothered by them. I once saw the Queen somewhere, and it was pretty thrilling. It was like seeing, you know, it was like seeing Madonna or something. It's like, wow, there's the Queen, there's Madonna, you know? But yeah, "God Save the Queen," because that started a whole revolution. And that, you talk about John Lennon making the perfect record. Never Mind the Bollocks is the most, and the Sex Pistols are the most complete band and record ever. That's it, full stop for me. To a band to be that good and then implode on your first tour is a sign of greatness. It's too much genius at work.
Well, it's such a fascinating thing too, because how old were you when you heard it?
12.
That's the perfect thing too, man. It's so, you know,
yeah, I was in the wheelhouse, you know?
Yeah. It's funny how that music you hear at that age, you know, causes such a resonance and.
Well, let me tell you, I've never made a record that I don't reflect on the lyrics and then listen to the Sex Pistols and go, do I really want to say all this, what I'm saying, when I could be singing fuck this and fuck that, fuck it all to fuck it, fucking Brent. I don't want a baby that looks like that. You know, bodies is the best thing ever in a song. And yet, at the same time, there's many songs like Black White Rainbows with all those kind of bruised, divorced songs that I was like, yeah, that's what I want to sing right now, so fuck it. But yeah, the Sex Pistols, they're the most perfect band to me. Again, it came in my life when it was the perfect time, and it really did change up. And there'd be no revolution like that anymore. No one cares enough anymore. But the way that just took over the country I was living in England, and the outrage. And who doesn't want, as 12 years old, want everyone to be outraged about things? It was brilliant. You know, it was incredible. You go spike your hair on a Friday night. I literally lived, before you got to the record store, at the top of my street where I lived, you get the 31 bus. The 31 bus used to go down to the King's Road. It's quite a distance on the bus. That's where the punks and the Teds used to walk up and down the King's Road. You'd have Seditionaries, which is Malcolm McLaren's shop. So I was like 12 years old. My sister was 15. So she had her older friends and all the punks and all the cute girls. And I just was like the token, you know, kid punk, you know, with like egg white in my hair. So you stick up, you know, and then you get on the bus and you'd have one t-shirt, you put a padlock around your neck and maybe a safety pin in you could put them in your face and put them in the thing here. Just everyone was like, and then you'd walk up and down the King's Road strutting. Nothing ever happened. I never spoke to anyone. I just sort of had like my drain pipes and my sort of, you know, ripped up shirt that I just copied Sid Vicious with. And that was it. And I even to the point where I gathered outside the Acklam Hall, Beaufort Street Market, where Public Image were going to play on the roof. And I remember standing around all day. I don't think they played, or maybe they played on the roof at the beginning of Pill. And it's just great to be part of that. Ostensibly, I was never really part of it because I was on the peripheries and I never got into anything. I never saw any bands, but just in the feeling. And I just would get that bus and stand around the King's Road all day long, just walking up and down. And the Teds, I didn't fight with them. I was 12 years old, but all the punks and the Teds used to sort of have, I don't know, face-offs. I'm not sure they ever kind of got into like heavy fighting, but it was always like the threat of violence and the Teddy Boys, because there's this great place, Kensington Market, we used to go. So it was all like punks and Teds. That's what it was.
Interesting. So when you go back now and listen to the Kingdom, I mean, are there songs in there, since you mentioned every record you go back and listen and hear the Sex Pistols, you know, what do you hear from the Sex Pistols on the Kingdom album?
The spite, you know, the kind of like the way that the delivery, like exactly the kingdom delivery. When I was singing that oppression lives in the mind of oppressor, we are the sons of the earth made mothers. I was spitting those words out. That's super Johnny Rotten, Johnny Lydon. That's like, that's his whole thing. Richard III and spit those lyrics out and just like that. And in fact, it's funny because I'm probably more in touch with that record and in that those performances now than ever. There's a lot of spite in those performances, specifically in the kingdom.
Interesting. What's the last protest song? We'll do one more.
Ku Klux Klan by the Steel Pulse.
Interesting. Okay.
Because, you know, I annoyingly start with the title of your show, so I want to make it a bit more, you know, I love Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, Sunny Bloody Sunday, it's written down, but Ku Klux Klan, because that record, Steel Pulse, Handsworth Revolution, was a massive record for me. We as young punks, you know, the tradition was, and Don Letts tells it best, you know, the only music outside of punk that you were allowed to listen to was reggae, because Don Letts, the DJ, you know, from Big Odor Dynamite, he spoke about how they just played reggae because there's no other records they could play. And every other, we used to go to this local youth club, Jewish youth club, and if they didn't play punk records or reggae, if they played pop songs, everyone would sit down. And then as soon as they played, like, you know, the punk song or a reggae song, you could stand up and you could, like, get into it. So this was a massive record for me. It's one of those records, you know, certain records you know backwards, you know. And so Steel Pulse, Handsworth Revolution, Ku Klux Klan. And, you know, it's obvious what that is. And that's why with the whole race thing for me, you know, I am so privileged to be from such a multicultural place as London, where it was nothing to do with race. It was just to do with sort of ability and where you lived. That was the kind of defining factor about different warring gangs and the way that they would operate, and different youth clubs that would fight each other and all that stuff. Not me. I was playing to soccer, so I wasn't really that guy. But I was always at the back. They have these like crazy, like stupid, like kid stuff of, like, you know, getting annoyed with another estate and their sort of issues and going down for these. Anyway, so Ku Klux Klan, incredible band, Steel Pulse.
And it's interesting. Do you hear a reggae vibe or their influence in the stuff that you do?
Everything. And all my bass lines I've ever done have been dubbed bass lines. Everything from Billy Cobham's bass line I used in Come Down. So all my bass lines, because I love dub, has always been that dubby approach. So I've always used reggae within my thing. And if you listen to like... The way that the drums are played and the feel of the drums is more of a, you know, the guy playing with us on this. Nick played on a few songs, the full-time new drummer, but the Gil Sharon played on the rest of it. And what I love about Gil is he's an amazing reggae player. So he has a lot of the kind of hi-hat stuff that I love, that sort of Omar Hakim thing. And you listen to like, what's it called now? I fucking had to change it. So Ghost in the Machine, that was originally named Slaves, you know, that, 6 months ago, that was just a really potent word. You know, I always get in trouble with my words. Bullet Holes was on its way to being a top 10 song, and like, it was a school shooting. I just like these incendiary words. And I used to annoy Gwen so much because I would use religious imagery. I'm an atheist, but I say, but the words are amazing. Sin, I love it. I love the word sin, but apparently it's just like, it's for religious connotation. Well, I'm having that back. Thank you. It's from the English language. So up yours.
Nice. It's funny. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, you know, when you think of those writers, and we'll make these last two questions, those writers who are able to bring that power out of words, who do that in a way that you know, because I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, that feeling of just taking these words, and it's like there are certain words that just have a poetry, a power, an image about them that every time you hear them, like I could never tell you why, but actually I read a short story once in a writing workshop I was doing that just made the most beautiful imagery of the word cerulean. And ever since then, I've absolutely loved that word. So for you, who are those writers that you think of that really bring out the power in words of poetry? Like Elvis Costello comes to mind right away. Like, you know, he has a poet.
I was going to say Paul Auster. Was my first answer was Paul Auster, because he's probably the greatest wordsmith I know.
But
he's an author, but as you know, I think that Thom Yorke has got a wonderful way of taking a phrase and making it work. I do, you know, his lyrics are very really interesting, and I'm not sure where he's at now, and I heard his last song, and it's all, I don't know, it's because it's all merging, but he's obviously amazing. Lyric wise, I don't really know, actually. I it's funny, it's an interesting question, because when I think of lyricists, I really go to a different generation. I don't really overly think about anyone in present music in the way that I sort of, you know, look at Dylan, look at Patti Smith, I look at Thom Waits. It's very hard to compete with those, just with those guys. I mean, no one can write like Thom and Kathleen. No, I mean, it's just not possible. You can't even, that's why I don't get into situational writing, descriptive writing. I just don't even try. I always work on the human condition. My life's work is the human condition, you know? And so that means I don't have to write about, you know, Cannibal Jack in a purple Mustang. It sounds ridiculous if I started doing it. It's not like I'm doing karaoke. So I have to write about stuff I know, which is stuff that just hurts me.
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny. And that's actually, we can wrap up. Oh, that's a great wrap up note. But it's funny because as we were just talking about, I had never thought about this question either. But then, you know, you look at, because I just got to see Patty. Patty was one of the last shows I saw before all of this happened, March 6th at Disney Hall. And she did Gloria and Land. And you think of it, I mean, has there ever been a more powerful opening line to a record ever than Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine?
Yeah, I'm not even trying to come close, because it's an incredible line. But I do like the line that I wrote in ambulances on Institute, which is one of my best opening lines I ever had, which is this staying alive can kill you. It's taken years off of my life.
That is an awesome line. That is a great line. But it's funny because I picked out the Pat. That is a great line. But it's the Patty one in particular, because it goes exactly to what you were saying. It's talking about the religion.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. It's so powerful. I mean, there's certain things, a couple of songs that didn't make the record, which were really religious based. Because part of it is also the fun I know of, like, you know, the outrage I cause in certain households with my religious imagery. I like it, but yeah. Patti Smith, she's the queen.
Cool. What do you want to add that we did not talk about?
I'm excited for people to hear the record, and that's it. And please write to me with any questions about the record. I accept all DMs.
Do you? Okay.
Well, I try. I try.
So you accept all DMs, but you're not going to tell people what specific lyrics are about.
No, I mean, they're pretty straightforward. You know, they're self-explanatory. You know, when I sing We Are the Sons of the Earth Made Mothers, you know, that's a sort of a, you know, that's a, we're all just humans. We're all just humans. Don't be hiding behind any ideology. You know, we're just like, that's what happened. You know, women gave birth and we began. And we're just people. And, you know, it's a very beautiful time, because it's so painful. And within all the pain we've all experienced through COVID, and then obviously COVID got cured by the Black Lives Matter movement, which is a great thing, but now we are seeing a resurgence. But there's an incredible thing that one lesson that we've got to take away from this is how we're so interdependent. And I love that interdependence. And we wanted to think we were islands, and then since we were asked to be islands, it killed everyone. Everyone was like, oh my God, I can't take it. You know, we're not islands. We are interdependent, and that's a beautiful thing.
Cool, dude. Always a pleasure. Yeah. Great song choices as well.
Great.
You know, congratulations on the record, and hopefully I'll get to see you do it live sooner rather than later, you know?
Thanks, brother.
Cool. Good seeing you.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Steve. Bye.
Hey, this is Steve Balton. You've been here on People Have the Power with frontman Gavin Rossdale. Thanks.